Hermes and IKEA can score identically on a brand health survey. One charges $10,000 for a handbag, the other $9.99 for a shelf. If your measurement system cannot distinguish them, the measurement system is not measuring what you think it is. This lecture is about building the measurement system that can.
It really is the core problem we're facing in the industry today.
Four ideas today. First, brands as eight-channel signal sources and why all eight channels matter independently. Second, why different observers assemble entirely different brands from identical signals.
Which is a huge paradigm shift.
Right. Third, five coherence types that predict crisis resilience better than any consistency score. And fourth, why brand perception compounds like interest order and trajectory matter as much as position.
Yeah, for anyone tuning in who, you know, really wants to understand the deep mechanics of business or consumer behavior, traditional tools are just failing us. We've historically treated marketing like an art form, right? Mm. Like something you just feel in your gut.
Yeah, definitely. Like a vibe. Yeah.
Exactly, a vibe. But our deep dive today into spectral brand theory, or SBT, completely upends that. This is backed by a massive formalization project. I mean, we're talking 20 research papers on Zenodo. It turns all that subjective brand art into rigorous, testable geometry.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately, because to understand why those traditional systems are basically hallucinating, we first have to agree on what a brand actually is.
Right.
And the source material is adamant here. A brand is not a static logo. It's not some corporate mission statement framed on a lobby wall. It is a continuous signal emitter.
A constant broadcast.
Yeah, but wait, I want to push back right out of the gate. As consumers, we're totally used to thinking of a brand as just a visual identity. What you're describing sounds like an eight-track mixing board in a recording studio. Are all eight channels really always playing?
They absolutely are, whether the company realizes it or not. Mm. And this is where the framework fundamentally shifts our understanding of market reality. The eight channels are the canonical SBT dimensions.
Okay, lay them out for us.
You've got semiotic, narrative, ideological, experiential, social, economic, cultural, and temporal. Every single one represents a completely distinct perceptual mechanism. You cannot compress them, and you can't reduce one to another.
Let's make this concrete for the listener, because just listing eight academic terms is a lot to digest. If I'm looking at this eight-track board, semiotic is just the visual and auditory identity, right? The Nike swoosh or the Netflix ta-dum sound.
Exactly. The surface recognition layer.
Right. And narrative is the story, like the founder's myth. Ideological is the values, the political stances. Experiential is the actual friction or joy of using the product.
Yeah, the physical reality of it.
Then social is the community, like what it says about my status. Economic is the pricing structure. Cultural is how it aligns with internet memes or the zeitgeist. And temporal is the heritage, the longevity.
That's a perfect summary. And what's really fascinating here is that the channels behave differently. Take the economic dimension, for instance. It is uniquely adversarial.
Wait, adversarial. Is it always adversarial? Because, well, think about Costco. When I go to Costco, I feel like we're on the same team. They just want to give me a hot dog for $1.50.
I know it feels collaborative. But functionally, it's still a zero-sum mechanism.
On the narrative or semiotic dimensions, you and the company can be perfectly aligned. You want an inspiring story, they want to tell one.
Everyone wins.
Right, everyone wins. But on the economic dimension, the structural reality is your interests, and the company's interests are permanently opposed. They mathematically require the highest possible margin to survive, and you want the lowest possible price to keep your capital.
Ah, okay. So Costco uses the membership model to soften that friction, but the friction is still there.
Precisely. The fundamental friction of the economic dimension remains. And the way a brand navigates that friction is by emitting signals.
Which brings us to how those signals are actually broadcast. The research breaks down the signals coming out of this eight-track board into three distinct types.
Let's hear them. First, you have positive signals. This is active communication, the Super Bowl ad, the new product launch. Second, you have null signals, which is accidental absence, like a brand just forgets to update their website.
Or they completely neglect their temporal heritage because a new CMO wants to look, you know, quote unquote, modern.
Right, exactly. But then we have the third type, which SBT calls structural absence, the dark signal.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the dark signal is perhaps the most counterintuitive concept in the entire theory. Structural absence is deliberate silence deployed as a strategy.
Deliberate silence.
Yeah, it's design scarcity. It is the perpetually empty shelf. It's the absolute refusal to offer a Black Friday discount. In physics, we talk about dark matter.
You can't see it, but it has gravitational pull.
Exactly. It doesn't emit light, but it pulls on the galaxies around it. Structural absence is invisible, but it's perceptually active. It pulls heavily on your perception of the brand.
Hermes makes billions by saying nothing. The silence is the strategy. I mean, think about it. They don't run massive discount campaigns.
Yeah.
They don't blast you with abandoned cart emails. You can't just walk into a boutique and buy a Birkin bag. There are wait lists, geographic restrictions.
It's an entire game you have to play.
Right. And that lack of an economic promotion, that structural absence, is the signal. It's a massive booming signal on the economic and temporal channels telling the observer, we are scarce, we are permanent, and we do not need your immediate transaction.
Exactly. And that deliberate silence requires an immense amount of discipline, which introduces an important question about control. SBT measures this control using the DA ratio, the design to ambient signal ratio.
Designed meaning the things the brand actively controls, and ambient meaning like the chaos of the outside world.
Precisely. Design signals are your intentional marketing, your controlled product experience, and your strategic silence. Ambient signals are everything you don't control.
The Reddit threads, the TikTok unboxings.
The angry customer reviews, the news coverage, yeah. And the research identifies a very specific Goldilocks zone for this ratio, sitting right around 55 to 65% design signals.
Wait, so you don't actually want 100% control? That seems totally counterintuitive. Wouldn't a CMO want to control every single narrative out there?
You'd think so, but if a brand hits 100% design signals, it feels dead. It feels like a corporate propaganda machine.
Ah, right. It's too sterile.
Exactly. There's no community, no organic life. You need that 35 to 45% of ambient noise to make the brand feel real. But, and this is the critical danger, if you drop below that 55% threshold, if ambient signals take over, the brand loses its architecture.
It becomes a hostage to its environment.
Yeah. The story is being written entirely by algorithms or angry customers or rogue influencers. You are literally no longer driving the car.
Okay, so if we understand that a brand is broadcasting on these 8 channels, constantly managing this delicate physics of design versus ambient signals, the next massive question for you as a listener is, who is actually listening to the broadcast?
Right, and are they all hearing the same song?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because traditional marketing loves to put us in neat little demographic boxes based on our age, gender, or zip code.
And this brings us to the illusion of demographic segmentation, which is arguably where the traditional marketing industry makes its most expensive mistakes.
Yeah, historically, market segmentation has relied on demographics. You know, you are a 35-year-old female living in an urban center, earning $85,000 a year. Therefore, you belong in Segment A.
And you get the Segment A emails. But spectral brand theory replaces this outdated model with observer cohorts.
A segment is who you are. A cohort is what you see. I just love the way the source material frames that.
It's perfect. Let's look at a concrete example. Imagine two 35-year-old women living in the exact same apartment building in Chicago.
Okay.
They work in the exact same corporate profession. They earn the exact same income. Demographically, to a traditional marketing dashboard, they are indistinguishable clones.
Right. The CRM software treats them identically.
But when they encounter a brand, let's say a high-end outdoor apparel company, their perceptual apparatus is entirely different.
Let's say woman A heavily weights the narrative and ideological dimensions. She cares about the founder's environmental activism.
Right.
She wants to know that the supply chain is ethical. If the brand does something politically controversial that aligns with her values, that is a massive positive signal to her.
Exactly. Now take woman B. She weights the economic and experiential dimensions heavily. She doesn't care about the founder's politics at all.
She just wants to know if the jacket is actually waterproof.
Right. Will it last 10 years?
Sure.
Is the warranty good? What's the price to durability ratio? These two women exist in the exact same demographic segment, but they are in entirely different observer cohorts.
They're literally assembling two completely different brands in their minds from the exact same set of 8 channel signals.
They really are. And to understand how that assembly process actually works in the brain, we have to look at what SBT calls a spectral profile.
The theory states that every single observer cohort has one, right? And it's made up of 5 formal components.
Yes. First, you have the spectrum, which is simply what you can see. It's your baseline sensitivity to those 8 dimensions.
Then you have your weights, which is what actually matters to you, like we just discussed with the two women in Chicago.
Then there's tolerances, which is how much inconsistency you're willing to accept before you lose trust and just walk away.
Fourth is priors. These are your deeply held existing convictions about the brand.
And finally, you have the identity gate.
Wait, the identity gate, that one is crucial.
It's the absolute baseline. Can you even recognize the brand at all? If you see the logo out of the corner of your eye, does it register?
Because if the signals don't pass the identity gate, the rest of the profile doesn't matter. The brand is just background radiation at that point.
Exactly. So we have these five components making up a spectral profile.
Mm-hmm.
And here is where the mathematics of high-dimensional geometry completely upend everything we thought we knew about marketing dashboards.
Yeah, the research notes that when we map these spectral profiles, we're operating in a geometric space called a 7-simplex. But hold on, before we lose people in the topology, let's visualize what that actually means. What is a 7-simplex, and why should a marketer care?
Well, let's break it down. Because your weights across the 8 dimensions have to add up to 100%. You only have so much attention to give the mathematical space of all possible observer profiles forms a specific geometric shape.
Okay.
In 3D space, this will look like a triangle or a tetrahedron. In 8-dimensional space, it's called a 7-simplex.
Got it.
Now, the research applies a deep principle from physics and statistics called the concentration of measure.
Concentration of measure, meaning where the data physically sits inside that shape.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
In low dimensions, like a flat circle on a piece of paper, the area spread out fairly evenly.
Sure.
But as you move into high-dimensional space, like our 8-track mixing board, the geometry behaves very weirdly. The volume of the shape gets pushed to the outside.
It just gets pushed to the edges.
Yeah, it becomes almost entirely concentrated near its boundaries. The math proves that if you try to divide this consumer space into discrete cohorts, at least 57% of all observer profiles lie within a 10% relative distance of a cohort boundary.
So, in plain English, mathematically, the majority of people are fence sitters.
Exactly.
They don't fit neatly into a hard-defined box. They are hanging out in the fuzzy boundary zones between different perceptual cohorts.
That is exactly what the geometry dictates. Hard clustering the practice of assigning every single consumer to one and only one definitive segment, which is literally what every CRM software in the world tries to do, is a geometrically lossy illusion.
It forces sharp, aggressive borders where the underlying mathematics just demand fuzziness.
Right. And this perfectly explains that incredible empirical test in the source material.
Oh, the AI test. This was wild.
The researchers took two independent, highly advanced AI models, Claude and Gemini, and asked them to analyze the exact same massive data set of brand signals to find the observer cohorts.
And Claude analyzed the data and said, there are 5 to 6 distinct cohorts here. But Gemini looked at the exact same data and said, no, there are 3.
And the punchline is, they were both mathematically correct.
Which is just a profound realization for anyone looking at data.
It really is. Both AIs were correct because the cohort structure is entirely dependent on the resolution you choose to view it at.
It's like zooming in on a coastline. Right.
Exactly. From space, the coast looks like a smooth curve. Zoom in, and it's jagged rocks. The boundary zone isn't a data error or an AI hallucination.
It is a fundamental, inescapable feature of high-dimensional space. The geometry simply does not support hard borders.
Precisely.
Okay, let's pause and map out where we are. We have this beautifully complex, multi-dimensional reality. We have brands emitting signals on 8 distinct channels, dealing with design versus ambient ratios.
Right.
And we have observer cohorts with highly nuanced, mathematically fuzzy profiles, perceiving those channels in entirely different ways.
Which leads us to a massive multi-billion dollar problem.
Right. Imagine you are the CMO of a mid-sized brand. Your dashboard says your overall brand health is a solid 78 out of 100.
Seems great.
You launch a new product, assuming your healthy brand will support it, and it completely flatlines. You're looking at your dashboard thinking, what went wrong? We're a 78.
Yeah. What happens when we try to compress all of that rich 8-dimensional perception into a single score?
What happens is a phenomenon the framework calls spectral metamerism. And this is the silent killer of brand strategy.
To understand this, we borrow a concept from color science. In optics, metamerism occurs when two light sources have completely different physical spectrums, different underlying wavelengths of light, but they look absolutely identical to the human eye.
Because our eyes only have 3 types of cone cells, so we compress the infinite complexity of the light spectrum down to just 3 variables.
Exactly. You could have 2 pieces of fabric that are dyed using completely different chemical compounds. Under fluorescent office lighting, they look like the exact same shade of navy blue.
But the moment you walk outside into natural daylight, one looks purple and the other looks green.
that is a metameric pair.
Mm-hmm.
They are fundamentally different, but under a specific type of compression in this case, human vision under artificial light, they appear identical.
And SBT proves mathematically that the exact same phenomenon happens in brand measurement. Two brands can score an identical 78 out of 100 on an equity index, but be structurally nothing alike.
Nothing alike at all.
I love the analogy here. It's like taking a highly complex, high-resolution 3D sculpture and shining a flashlight on it to cast a 2D shadow against a wall. If you look only at the shadow, two entirely different sculptures can cast the exact same silhouette.
The single dashboard score is just a shadow.
It is entirely a shadow, and the Johnson-Lindenstrasse lemma gives us the mathematical proof of just how violently distorting that shadow really is.
This is a foundational theorem in high-dimensional geometry. It proves that if you project eight dimensions down to one dimension, which is literally what you were doing when you average out survey responses to create a single brand score, you are going to experience massive, unavoidable distortion.
Let's put some numbers to that distortion, because it's staggering.
The math shows that for just 10 brands, the required distortion to map them onto a single line exceeds 152%.
Wow.
For 50 brands, the distortion hits 198%. When you compress the data this way, you create what mathematicians call a seven-dimensional null space.
A null space, so a place where data simply vanishes.
Exactly. It is a mathematical black box where all the actual structural differences between the brands hide.
So if you use a standard five-point grading scale on a survey, you know, rate this brand from 1 to 5, you are capturing only about 2.32 bits of information from a roughly 20-bit profile.
Which means you are actively throwing away nearly 89% of the structural information about how your consumers perceive you.
89% data loss. That is insane.
Monte Carlo simulations in the research show that 31 to 39% of all brand pairs are metameric. That means over a third of the time, two brands that score identically are actually structurally distinct.
Every brand score you have ever seen is a lossy compression of something richer.
That's a great way to put it.
Let's visualize this, because this is where the Hermes and IKEA hook from the beginning really clicks into place. Imagine a radar chart with eight axes, one for each dimension.
Okay.
If you walk around the 3D sculpture of Hermes and map it onto this chart, you get a tall, highly eccentric polygon. It's spiking huge on the semiotic, temporal, and cultural axes, but it is completely flat and contracted on the economic axis.
Because as we discussed, their strategy relies on structural absence there.
Exactly. Now, map IKEA on the exact same radar chart. You get a wider, rounder polygon. It's incredibly balanced across most dimensions, but it has a massive, towering spike on the economic dimension.
Because democratic, accessible pricing is their absolute core.
Right. They are mirror opposites in geometric shape. But a standard survey asks, do you like this brand? Would you recommend this brand?
And it collapses those beautiful, distinct geometric shapes into the exact same flat number. 78.
The dashboard is actively lying to the CEO because it can't see depth. It is entirely blind to the architecture.
And if the score is blind to the architecture, then using it to make strategic decisions in a crisis is like driving down a highway with your eyes closed, relying on a passenger who can only tell you if you are generally moving forward.
That is terrifying for any business owner.
Since we know single consistency scores are lying to us through spectral metamerism, we need a better way to evaluate a brand's actual health and resilience. And the answer the framework provides isn't consistency. It's coherence type.
Let's clarify the difference between those two words, because marketers use them interchangeably all the time, and they are definitely not the same thing.
Not at all.
Consistency is just repeating the exact same signal over and over. It's making sure the logo is the exact same hex code of blue on the website and the billboard.
It's using the same tagline everywhere.
Right. But coherence is entirely different. Coherence is not repeating the same signal. It is the structure that makes your brand survive. The observer who vehemently disagrees with you.
Yes.
It's about how the different observer cohorts are structurally interdependent.
Consistency is about the sender. Coherence is about the receivers. And SBT identifies a highly specific taxonomy of five distinct coherence types.
Okay, let's walk through them.
The first, and historically the most resilient, is ecosystem coherence. This is the Hermes model.
Okay, how does that work?
The observer cohorts are functionally interdependent. You have the heritage client who buys the saddles, the fashion connoisseur who buys the runway pieces, the aspirational buyer who saves up for a scarf, and the investment buyer flipping bags on the secondary market.
And what happens to ecosystem coherence when a crisis hits? Say there's a massive global recession.
When macroeconomic disruption hits, the core actually gets stronger. Yeah. The aspirational buyers might fall away because they don't have the disposable income, but that structural absence actually increases the scarcity, which makes the brand more valuable to the heritage and investment clients.
Ah, so peripheral cohorts are shed, but the center hardens. It possesses selective resilience.
Exactly. Now, the second type is signal coherence. This is the IKEA model. All the signals perfectly align: the flat pack furniture, the meatballs, the bright blue warehouse.
But the cohorts are independent, right?
Right. A broke college student outfitting their first dorm room and a wealthy architect buying a minimalist shelving system for their studio both see the exact same functional democratic value.
But wait, if they are independent, doesn't that mean IKEA is vulnerable?
It does. Because the cohorts aren't interdependent, there is no selective defense. If a disruption happens, say, a massive supply chain failure that forces IKEA to double their prices, that pain is transmitted uniformly across everyone.
The college student and the architect both abandon the brand because the core economic signal has been violated. There is no inner core to fall back on.
That's right. The third type is identity coherence. Think of Patagonia.
Okay, Patagonia.
They have a massive ideological core that actively repels misaligned observers and fiercely attracts aligned ones. The coherence actually comes from that polarization.
When they say, don't buy this jacket, or when they sue the government over public lands, they are intentionally alienating a huge portion of the demographic segment.
But the cohorts that remain become fanatically loyal.
That makes total sense. Okay, fourth is experiential asymmetry. And this is a fascinating modern phenomenon. Think of Erewhon, the luxury grocery store in Los Angeles.
Yeah, this coherence type relies almost entirely on mediated perception.
Right. It relies on social hype, influencer culture, and the social dimension rather than direct experiential interaction.
Most people who follow Erewhon online have never been inside the store or tasted the $20 smoothie.
It's all ambient, no anchor.
Precisely. The social channel is turned up to 11. But the temporal and experiential channels are incredibly weak. This makes it highly vulnerable to temporal decay.
Because the moment the influencers decide the brand is no longer cool, the entire architecture collapses. There is no historical or functional foundation to hold it up.
Exactly. And that brings us to the fifth type, incoherent. And the ultimate case study here is Tesla.
Okay, I have to challenge the premise here. Look at Tesla's market cap. Look at their sales volume over the last decade. If they are so incoherent across these cohorts, shouldn't they be failing?
That's a fair point.
It seems like weaponized chaos is actually working for them. Can a brand deliberately choose incoherence as a strategy to reach a larger, more diverse audience? Why is incoherence inherently a vulnerability?
It's a fantastic question. In the short term, incoherence can absolutely drive massive growth because you are allowing people to project whatever they want onto the brand.
Yeah.
But let's look at Tesla's spectral profile geometrically.
Okay.
The narrative and semiotic dimensions are incredibly strong. Everyone recognizes the cars, and the story of transitioning the world to sustainable energy is potent. But the ideological and temporal dimensions are structurally volatile. This creates a situation where the innovation devotee cohort, the tech enthusiasts, simply treats the CEO's controversial ideological signals on Twitter as background noise.
It doesn't pass their filter. They only care about the software updates and the 0 to 60 times.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the progressive boycotter cohort treats those exact same ideological signals as the dominant signal defining the entire brand.
So you have different cohorts pulling completely opposite meanings from the exact same signal source. Tesla is consistent. Everyone recognizes the shape of the car.
Right.
But Tesla is incoherent. Five different cohorts hold utterly contradictory convictions about what the brand actually stands for.
And this is why incoherence is a long-term vulnerability. It works until the friction between those cohorts becomes unsustainable. Because brand perception isn't a static snapshot. It's not a photograph you take once a year for a dashboard.
It's a compounding process.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the actual physics of how we form these convictions in our minds. SBT tells us that brand perception is non-ergodic.
That's a heavy academic term.
It is, but it essentially means perception compounds multiplicatively, not additively. Let me translate that. It means your brain is not a simple scorecard where a positive signal is a +1 and a negative signal is a -1, and they just cancel each other out to 0.
The sequence of events matters deeply.
Exactly. If you get a severe negative signal, it changes the fundamental chemistry of how your brain receives future signals. A negative signal suppresses the weight of future positive signals entirely.
It's like flipping a coin, where every time you lose, your total bankroll is cut in half, but every time you win, you only gain 10%. The path you take determines your survival.
That's a brutal game.
Let's trace the actual pipeline of how a conviction is formed in the observer's mind. It starts with Adam's discrete individual signals from the brand. An ad, a tweet, a broken zipper.
And as these atoms are encountered, they form a probabilistic perception cloud in the observer's mind. It's essentially a working hypothesis. I think this brand means high-quality luxury.
It's like a nebula of gas before a star is born. It's just floating there, gathering mass.
And as more and more evidence accumulates, this cloud grows denser. Eventually, the weight of the evidence crosses a specific personalized threshold, and it triggers what the theory calls a conviction collapse.
The hypothesis crystallizes into a confirmed brand fact.
The star ignites. You no longer think they're high quality, you know they are high quality.
But those facts aren't permanent. If highly contradictory evidence suddenly appears, say the luxury brand is caught in a massive child labor scandal, or the cars start spontaneously catching fire, that brand fact dissolves.
The perception cloud is blown apart and forced into a recollapse.
Yes. You have to rebuild your understanding of the brand from whatever surviving evidence remains.
And this non-ergodic compounding is what creates the most dangerous phenomenon in marketing, the absorbing state.
Let's return to that Tesla progressive boycotter cohort. Because of path dependence, the specific order and heavy weight of the negative ideological signals they've received over the last few years, this cohort has entered an absorbing state on the ideological dimension.
So in plain English, someone's hatred for a brand's politics becomes a black hole.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter if that brand suddenly builds the best, cheapest, longest-range electric car on the planet. The gravity of their political disgust is so strong that the good news literally cannot escape it. The brain won't even process the car's features.
That is precisely what the math dictates. Their negative conviction has crystallized so hard that new positive product signals on the experiential dimension simply bounce off.
The mathematical threshold required to reverse that conviction and force a recollapse is impossibly high.
It is.
So what does this all mean for you if you're the decision maker? It means you cannot PR your way out of an absolving state.
You really can't.
You cannot run a shiny new ad campaign to fix a structural, ideological black hole. The math says that specific cohort literally isn't processing your good news anymore.
You can't just add good PR to balance out the bad. The bad has fundamentally altered their spectral profile. The gate is closed.
Which is why understanding this underlying geometry is so critical. If you are using a flat 1 to 100 dashboard, you will never see the absorbing state forming until it is far too late.
Now, I want to be clear here. All of this physics, this high-dimensional topology, the simplices and null spaces, it might sound like we are suggesting you throw out decades of established marketing theory.
Right.
We aren't. We are finally giving it a coordinate system.
Exactly. Every brand strategist knows the giants of the industry. David Aker's brand identity model, Kevin Lane Keller's customer-based brand equity, Jean-Noël Kapfer's brand identity prism.
These are the frameworks that build modern marketing. SBT is a formalization of those frameworks, not a replacement.
The analogy here is crucial. Think about the relationship between classical economics and behavioral economics.
Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky didn't invalidate Adam Smith. They didn't throw out the concepts of supply and demand.
What they did was add precision. They mapped exactly where the assumptions of the classical models fail, where human irrationality, anchoring, and cognitive bias bend the theoretical curves.
SBT does the exact same thing for Aker and Keller. It adds the empirical measurement layer they couldn't possibly have had 30 years ago.
Let's look at how SBT unbundles Aker's work. Aker's model has this famous perspective called brand as organization. It's a great conceptual bucket, but it literally bundles together a company's values, its cultural codes, and its heritage all into one single entity.
And SBT comes in and unbundles that into the ideological, cultural, and temporal dimensions.
Now, instead of asking a vague, unanswerable question like, is our brand as organization strong? You can measure precisely which dimension is working. You might have massive cultural relevance, but zero temporal trust.
Furthermore, Aker's model inherently assumes a homogeneous market.
It assumes zero observer heterogeneity.
Right. It assumes that if the brand projects a specific identity, everyone in the target demographic is looking at it through the exact same lens. And SBT shows that Aker's model works perfectly. It is mathematically sound only when everyone shares the identical spectral profile.
But the moment you introduce the real messy world, Well, the moment your audience contains both an innovation devotee and a progressive boycotter within the same demographic, the classical model breaks down.
You absolutely need SBT's eight-dimensional math to understand why your signals are fracturing.
So let's bring this all together and synthesize the journey we've been on. Brands aren't flat, two-dimensional objects that you can slap onto a neat two-by-two positioning map.
They are highly complex, high-dimensional, multi-channel emitters broadcasting on eight distinct frequencies.
Single scores, like a 78 out of 100 on an executive dashboard, are geometric illusions that hide the architectural reality of what you are actually building.
True measurement requires you to understand the observer's unique spectral profile.
It requires you to acknowledge the fuzzy, mathematically inevitable boundaries between different cohorts.
And it requires you to build a specific coherence type that dictates exactly how your brand will survive the next unavoidable crisis.
If you want the mathematical foundations, the metric space, the Fischer-Rau geometry, the sphere packing bounds that is lecture two, if you want the practitioner path, how to run a spectral audit on a real brand, listen to episode two next.
Next time you look at a competitor's dashboard or a brand's customer satisfaction score, don't ask if the number is good or bad. Ask yourself, what shape is hiding inside that shadow? And who is the observer making that shape exist? Because the number doesn't remember, but the architecture dictates the future.